All right. Deuteronomy chapter 2 is where we are today. We had an introduction to the book yesterday, and we covered only chapter 1. And that means we are still working on the first discourse of Moses in the book. There are at least three discourses, and the first one is fairly short. It ends near the end of chapter 4. And we need to finish that up in this session, and I actually hope we'll get beyond that point this session. Now, what we have is largely a retelling of stories that we've studied in Exodus and in Numbers. Deuteronomy is an interesting mix of repetition and new material. The laws that are in it, as I pointed out yesterday, are about 50% repetition of previously stated laws and about 50% new laws. Likewise, the history is mostly repetitious of history that's been mentioned before, but it also has some details added which were not mentioned when the same stories were told in previous books. And I'm going to try to avoid the temptation to comment on the material that has already been covered. Now remember, I didn't teach Numbers for you, and therefore I may be tempted to make points about some of these stories that I would have made if I had taught Numbers. But I have to remember, you've already been through Numbers, and I don't need to teach these stories as though we haven't already covered them. I do want to point out where differences or additional information is given by Moses on this occasion, as opposed to the information we had previously in the telling of stories. But it will be profitable for me, if I can make myself do it, to read through these stories only concentrating on those things that are distinctive to the Deuteronomy account, rather than, as I said, treating it like we haven't heard these stories before. Now, in chapter 1, he recounted some of the things of their history. He first talked about God telling them to leave Mount Sinai and how that they had encamped there for a while. And the cloud began to move, as we know from the story in Numbers, although here it doesn't talk about the cloud moving so much. It just talks about God commanding them in chapter 1, verse 6, to move along. He then goes on to talk about an event that had happened previous to that, the appointment of judges over tens and fifties and hundreds and thousands, which was actually done at the suggestion of Jethro, Moses' father-in-law, as recorded way back in Exodus 18. He then talks to them about their refusal to enter the land, which is what the rest of chapter 1 from about verse 19 on was about. He talks about their request to send spies into the land, which again is information that was not given to us in Numbers. We are not told that they were the ones who came up with the idea of sending spies, but here we are told that. But we are familiar with the following material, how that the spies came back, disheartened the people, and the people refused to go into the land. They had no faith in God, and God said, okay, then your whole generation is going to die here in the wilderness. And when the people heard that, they changed their minds and decided they would go up and try to take the land at this time, but God said, no, I've already changed my mind about this, and I'm not going with you. Yet they went against their enemies and were humiliated in defeat. They came back weeping, realizing that they were not going to be able to take the land now. After all, they had missed their chance. And chapter 2, verse 1 then continues the story. Then we turned and journeyed into the wilderness of the way of the Red Sea, as the Lord spoke to me, and we skirted Mount Seir for many days. Actually, many days was 38 years. Apparently for those 38 years, they went around the mountainous region of Seir, which was technically the country of the Edomites, had previously belonged to the Horites, but the Edomites had displaced them. You might remember how that Esau, last time we heard from him in the book of Genesis, when he met with Jacob the last time we read of it, he was on his way to Mount Seir, possibly on his way there to conquer the region. At any rate, by this time, the Edomites had conquered Mount Seir, and so this was actually a mountainous region, not just one mountain. And the Israelites apparently just went around, skirted the mountain for 38 years. It says many days here in verse 1, though the length of time is actually given more accurately in verse 14, where he says the time that it took to come from Kadesh Barnea until we crossed over the valley of Zered was 38 years. So you can connect the many days of verse 1 with the 38 years of verse 14. And the Lord spoke to me, verse 2, saying, You've skirted this mountain long enough. So we pass over those 38 years in a single verse in chapter 2, verse 1. And we come now to the extremely recent events that Moses had and the people had just been experiencing. The Lord spoke to me, saying, "You have skirted this mountain long enough. Turn northward and command the people, saying, 'You are about to pass through the territory of your brethren, the descendants of Esau, who live in Seir. And they will be afraid of you. Carefully watch yourselves. Therefore, watch yourselves carefully. Do not meddle with them, for I will not give you any of their land. No, not so much as a footstep, because I have given Mount Seir to Esau as a possession. You shall buy food from them with money that you may eat, and you shall also buy water from them with money that you may drink. For the Lord your God has blessed you in all the work of your hand. He knows you're trudging through this great wilderness these 40 years, the Lord your God has been with you, and you've lacked nothing." And it says, "And we passed beyond our brethren, the descendants of Esau who dwell in Seir, away from the road of the plain, away from Elath and Ezion-Geber, we turned and passed by way of the wilderness to Moab. Now, this talk about going through Mount Seir and God saying you can buy food and water from them, but don't take their land from them, is a little perplexing. Because the only actual dealings with the Edomites that are recorded in Numbers pertaining to this very period are in Numbers chapter 20, where we read that Moses sent messengers to the Edomite king and said, "Give us permission to walk through your land, and we won't bother your territory. We'll just stick to the king's highway and not invade your vineyards or anything like that. And any food or water that we use, we'll pay for. Just let us pass through. That's all we're asking." And we are told in Numbers chapter 20 that the king sent his armies out and said, "You're not coming through here." And so the children of Israel turned away and didn't pass through. And yet here we have God saying, "You shall buy food from them with money, and you may eat." And he talks about in verse 7 how that apparently, well, not verse 7, but verse 8, "We pass beyond our brethren, the descendants of Esau, who dwell in Seir." Now, beyond could mean around rather than through. It may be that in verse 6, God, before they had sent messengers, said, "You have permission to buy from these people, but don't take their land." But then, as it turned out, the king of the land wouldn't allow it. And so they passed by, they passed around. However, there is a further problem. When you come over to, somewhat later in the discourse, if I can find it quickly, because he mentions again, in verse 29, same chapter, when he talks about asking King Sion to allow him to pass through, he says, "Just as the descendants of Esau who dwell in Seir and the Moabites who dwell in Ar did for me until I crossed the Jordan to the land which the Lord our God has given us." I should have read the previous verse so you know exactly what he's saying the people of Edom did for him. He says in verse 28, "You shall sell me food for money that I may eat, and give me water for money that I may drink. Only let me pass through on foot, just as the descendants of Esau who dwelt in Seir and the Moabites who dwelt in Ar did for me." So it sounds like he's saying the Edomites did allow us to pass through and did sell us food and water, which is very perplexing. In fact, I must confess, of all the material in the book of Deuteronomy, I don't think anything is more perplexing to me than this statement. Because, as I said, the previous telling of the story indicates that the Edomites did not let them come through. Now, there's a couple of ways that I could see to solve this. I don't know which one may be correct or if there's another one I'm not thinking of. One is that certainly Mount Seir was a spread-out region. And it may be that one part of the region of Seir, the part where the king lived and his armies were stationed, did not let them pass through, but they passed through another part of the region and were permitted to. That is, that the government took an official policy of saying, "No, you can't come through here and we won't sell you anything." But some of the individuals who lived on the outskirts of the territory, for the sake of money and maybe out of compassion, allowed the Jews to pass through their territory and sold them food and water. That is possible. It is also possible he says in chapter 2, verse 1, that we skirted Mount Seir for many days. It may be that prior to asking the king of Edom to go through, they were still, of course, in the general region of Seir, and all those 38 years, the people of that region allowed them on their territory and sold them food and water and so forth. But at a later point, at the end of 38 years, when they specifically asked to penetrate and go through the territory, that they were not allowed to do so. I really don't know. One of those possibilities seems to me within reason as an explanation. Of course, there are those who just try to use this as an example of a contradiction in the Bible, but it's very serious to suggest that this would be a contradiction. First of all, it's very unlikely that it would be. If Moses is indeed the author of Deuteronomy and of Numbers, it seems very unlikely that he would forget what their experience had been with Edom. If, in fact, Edom had said, no, we won't let you go through, and sent armies out to resist them doing so, that he would, you know, shortly afterwards say, remember how the Edomites let us go through? I mean, that there'd be some mistake there on his part seems really incredible. On the other hand, if we accept the liberal approach that Moses didn't write Deuteronomy, it was written much later, nonetheless, it bears so much resemblance in so many features to the stories in Numbers that whoever wrote Deuteronomy would have been familiar with the book of Numbers, obviously. And it seems strange, again, that they would make such a mistake as this when the book of Numbers is so plain in its statement about their dealings with the Edomites. It's far more likely, therefore, to me, that there is some harmonization of the material that made sense to Moses and his listeners. Remember, there are 38 years of dealings with Mount Seir that are not recorded specifically and passed over in a single verse in chapter 2, verse 1. And it may be that in chapter 2, verse 29, when he speaks of the children of Esau who dwell in Seir, allowing him to pass through, and when it speaks of them selling him food and water in verse 6, that this refers to the fact that this happened, you know, with something sort of as the unofficial policy of some of the Edomites, though the king himself was not friendly and wouldn't let them pass through on the king's highway as they requested. I may not be right about that, but if I'm not, I'm not sure what is right about that.
Are you saying that they kind of went on the outskirts?
Yeah, I'm saying that for 38 years they skirted Mount Seir. They were on the edges of the territory, apparently. And there must have been some Edomites who lived, you know, in those far-flung regions who would be willing to sell food and give water to them. Again, whether that's the way to harmonize this or not, I'm not certain. But if it's not that, I'm not sure that it's within our ability with the information that we have to know how this harmonizes. Okay, verse 9. Then the Lord said to me, do not harass Moab, nor contend with them in battle, for I will not give you any of their land as a possession, because I have given Ar to the descendants of Lot as a possession. Now it's interesting. This is as they were approaching the land of Moab, as they apparently left the region of Edom, coming to Moab. God told Moses, don't bother these people. Now when we read in Numbers chapter 22, that the king of Moab, Balak, saw them coming, he was terrified, and of course he hired Balaam. And there's all that rigmarole that took about six chapters or so of Numbers, you know, along maybe five chapters of Numbers, to talk about how he paid Balaam to do all this stuff, and eventually Balaam, induced the people to commit a fornication and worship idols so that God brought the plague of Baal Peor upon them. All of that seems to have been unnecessary, because God had already told the children of Israel not to bother Moab. King Balak's fears were apparently unfounded. He paid money to Balaam to prevent the Israelites from hurting him. And yet God had already told them not to. But of course, Balak didn't know that. And therefore, all that complication, all the money spent by Balak, all the trials Balaam went through, and then of course the sin of the people at Baal Peor and their plague that killed all those, was absolutely uncalled for, because if Balak had just waited, he would have seen that these people were not hostile toward him. Because God spoke to them as they approached Moab, not to harass Moab or to contend with them in battle. As it turned out, even though that was God's original instruction to them as they approached Moab, because of this incident at Baal Peor, there was a war. I mean, and as a judgment against the Moabites for this, God did bless the Israelites and actually tell them to fight against the Moabites, and they did, and they killed Midianites, and they killed Moabites, and they killed Balaam, and that was not God's original intention. He intended for them to leave Moab alone, but Moab didn't leave them alone, and eventually battle ensued. But even though they did fight with the Moabites, eventually they did not take their land, which is again what God told them not to do. Don't try to take any of their land. That's not part of the possession I'm giving to you. I've given that to the descendants of Lot. Now, first, the Edomites, whom God said, I've given them such and such land, Mount Seir, they were relatives of Israel, remote, because they were descended from Esau, who was the twin brother of Jacob. And therefore, these two nations had common ancestry. Likewise, somewhat more remote ancestry linked the children of Israel with the Moabites and the Ammonites. The Moabites and the Ammonites were both descended from Lot. Lot was not descended from Abraham, but was Abraham's nephew, and therefore was close relative of at least the Israelites, the Moabites, and the Ammonites could all trace their ancestry back to Terah, Abram's father. And so again, they were relatives. They were brother nations. And so God had given them land as well. Now concerning the land that God had given to the children of Lot, in verses 10 and 11 it says, the Emim had dwelt there in times past, a people as great and numerous and tall as the Anakim. They were also regarded as giants like the Anakim, but the Moabites called them the Emim. The Horites formerly dwelt in Seir, but the descendants of Esau dispossessed them and destroyed them from before them and dwelt in their place, just as Israel did to the land of their possession which the Lord gave them. I mentioned yesterday that this statement at the end of verse 12, their possession which the Lord gave them, that is, gave Israel. And just as Israel dispossessed the Canaanites, is a statement that must be made after Moses' lifetime. It's one of those editorial enlargements on the text. Possibly Joshua included it, or some other inspired writer at a later date. That whole parenthesis in verses 10 through 12, therefore, is an expansion given by someone other than Moses, living after Moses' time, it would seem. The purpose of that is to show that whereas the children of Israel did not trust God at Kadesh Barnea in Numbers chapter 14, did not trust that he could give them the land that was possessed by giants, Anakim. Yet the Moabites, who didn't even know the true God, had taken their territory from giants who were just as big as the Anakim. In other words, the Moabites apparently had more faith in their false god, Chemosh, than the Israelites had in Jehovah. And that seems to be the reason for putting this parenthetical statement in here. We have a similar statement when it's talking about the children of Ammon, down in verse 20 and following, it says, that also was regarded to be a land of giants. This is where the children of Ammon had taken possession. The word giants in this case is Rephaim. It's not Anakim, but it is another race of giants. Giants formerly dwelt there, but the Ammonites called them Zamzumim, a people of great and numerous and tall as the Anakim. Again, the Anakim are the ones that the children of Israel complained that they had seen. The spies who came back said, we saw the sons of Anak there, the Anakim. We could never beat them. And yet the Emims, in verse 10, whom the Moabites displaced, and the Zamzumim, in verse 20, whom the Ammonites displaced, were both said to be as tall as the Anakim. The Anakim, who had so intimidated the Israelites, did not apparently intimidate the Moabites, or at least people of equal size, did not intimidate the Moabites or the Ammonites, who apparently had more faith in their false gods than Israel had in their true God. And that's the purpose of these editorial statements, to show that the heathen themselves often exhibit more displaced trust in gods that aren't worthy of trust than the Jews have put in their God who is worthy of trust. It says, by the way, the same thing about the Philistines in verse 23, within the same parenthesis. It says, and the Avim who dwelt in villages as far as Gaza, the Kaphtorim who came from Kaphtor, destroyed them and dwelt in their place. The Kaphtorim are the Philistines. Kaphtor is the ancient name for the island Crete, from which the Philistines originated. The Philistines came by ship from Crete over to Palestine and established five cities in about this period, and Gaza was one of them. And it talks about how the Kaphtorim, or that is the Philistines, took Gaza from the Avim. So we're getting basically some editorial comments that give us some idea of who possessed these lands originally before those inhabitants who became the contemporaries of the children of Israel in their land. When Israel was in their land, their neighboring people were the Edomites and the Moabites and the Ammonites and the Philistines. But it's now telling us who was in all those locations before those groups were there. And it makes a point of saying all those groups had to drive out previous inhabitants, many of whom were giants just like the Anakim. But that didn't stop them. So why did it stop the Israelites? Because they were faithless. Back to verse 13, after that first parenthesis is over, it says, "Now rise and cross over the valley of Zered." So we crossed over the valley of Zered. And the time we took to come from Kadesh Barnea until we crossed over to the valley of Zered was 38 years, until all the generation of the men of war was consumed from the midst of the camp, just as the Lord had sworn to them. That is, the men of the previous generation who had been above 20 years old at the previous provocation. They were now all dead after 38 years of wandering. "For indeed the hand of the Lord was against them to destroy them from the midst of the camp until they were consumed. So it was, when all the men of war had finally perished from among the people, that the Lord spoke to me, saying, 'This day you are to cross over at Ar, the boundary of Moab. And when you come near to the people of Ammon," of course, additional children, descendants from Lot, just like the Moabites were. Ammon and Moab were descended from the two sons of Lot. "Do not harass them or meddle with them, for I will not give you any of the land of the people of Ammon as the possession, because I have given it to the descendants of Lot as a possession." And then we have this long parenthesis. "That was also regarded as land of giants. Giants formerly dwelt there, but the Ammonites called them Zamzaman, a people great and as great and numerous and tall as the Anakim. But the Lord destroyed them before them." Now notice, the Ammonites didn't necessarily trust in Jehovah God. They had another God, but it was Jehovah who destroyed the giants before the Ammonites. It was God who gave them the land of possession. Their false idol didn't give them that land. The Moabites and Ammonites both are said, and the Edomites also, all of whom worshipped other gods. It is said that Jehovah gave them their land as a possession. They may not have honored him, they may not have recognized him, but he is the one who drove out the giants before them, and the same God could certainly drive out the giants before the children of Israel, of course. Verse 22, "Just as he had done for the descendants of Esau who dwelt in Seir, when he destroyed the Horites from before them, they dispossessed them and dwelt in their place even to this day. And the Avim who dwelt in the villages as far as Gaza, the Kaphtorim who came from Kaphtor, destroyed them and dwelt in their place." Again, the parenthesis ends. Verse 24. At verse 24, we have sort of a change of policy. Up until this point, Moses is just recounting the people that God did not permit them to attack. The Edomites, the Moabites, the Ammonites. But at verse 24, it starts talking about whom God did tell them to attack. And there were two kings that they fought against and defeated. The king of Heshbon and the king of Bashan, that is, Sion and Og. And they did, under God's command, attack these two kings because they were Canaanites. They were not brother nations like Edomites and Moabites and Ammonites were, but the people of Bashan and Heshbon were Canaanite in extraction and therefore were part of the cursed race that was to be exterminated. And therefore, even though they had not yet come into the land, because Bashan and Heshbon were east of the Jordan, that is, not within Palestine, yet they were to begin their conquest of the land outside the land, on the eastern side. Now, this beginning of aggressions was to serve four purposes, all of which are stated. Well, three of which are stated. One can be implied. The one that I could say would be implied is that it was a timely judgment upon Og and his people and Sion and his people. That was certainly the case with the Canaanites on the other side of the Jordan. We must assume it was true on these Canaanites on the east side of the Jordan as well. That the reason God sent the Israelites in was partially because it was time for those nations to be judged. But the other purposes, there are three that are stated for God sending Israel in a military excursion against Sion and Og, were one, in verse 25, it would establish Israel's reputation among the nations as a warrior nation. Let me read verse 24 and 25 and you'll see that. "Rise, take up your journey and cross over the river Arnon. Look, I have given into your hand Sion, the Amorite." Not to be confused with Ammonite. The Amorites were Canaanites. The Ammonites were from Ammon, from Lot. "King of Heshbon and his land, begin to possess it and engage him in battle. This day I will begin to put the dread and fear of you upon the nations under the whole heaven, who shall hear the report of you and shall tremble and be in anguish because of you." So there's one reason, another reason why he's engaged them in battle against Sion, because he wants to start to establish Israel's reputation, to put the fear of them in the other nations that they're going to possess, to somewhat intimidate their enemies. Another reason for it is given not until we get to verse 31, but we might as well look ahead. In verse 31, he says, "And the Lord said to me, See, I have begun to give Sion and his land over to you to begin to possess it, that you may inherit his land." So another reason God had them fight against Sion was so that they could take his land. Although it was not in Palestine, it became the possession of 2.5 tribes. Reuben, Gad, and the half-tribe of Manasseh eventually occupied this land that was taken from Sion and Og. So it was actually in order to displace, to judge those people, to establish the reputation of Israel, and also to take their land, which is in contrast to the Edomites, Moabites, and Ammonites, whom God said, don't take their land. Yet this land on the east of Jordan became part of the inheritance of Israel. Gad, Manasseh, and Reuben received inheritances on that side of the Jordan. And there's a fourth reason why God led them to battle against these kings. And we see that down much later in chapter 3, verse 21 and 22. It says, "And I commanded Joshua at that time, saying, Your eyes have seen all that the Lord your God has done to these two kings," that is Sion and Og. "So will the Lord do to all the kingdoms through which you pass. You must not fear them, for the Lord your God himself fights for you." In other words, God was giving them a precedent. When they crossed Jordan, they'd be facing much more enemies than they had here on the east side of Jordan. But he would give them some initial victories to give them something to look back on and encourage their faith. So it was to encourage their faith for future victories. So these early battles, these battles that were a precursor to actually crossing the Jordan, and these defeats of these two kings, had four purposes. One, to judge those kings. Two, to establish the reputation of Israel as a militarily victorious nation. Three, to take the land for possession of the tribes of Gad, Manasseh, and Reuben. And four, to help the faith of the Israelites as they were about to go undertake even greater exploits on the other side of the river. They would need some faith, and God often builds your faith by giving you smaller victories first. Like David, when he was facing the Philistine giant, said, "Well, God delivered me out of the hand of a lion once, and out of the hand of a bear once, and I have every reason to believe the same God who delivered me from the lion and the bear will deliver me from this Philistine."
Yeah.
And so also here, God gives them some preliminary victories, so that they might have faith to trust God for the victories of a greater crisis that they would face on the other side of Jordan. Okay, verse 26. "And I sent messengers from the wilderness of Kedemoth to Sion, the king of Heshbon, with words of peace, saying, Let me pass through your land. I will keep strictly to the road, and I will neither turn to the right or the left. You shall sell me food for money that I may eat, and give me water for money that I may drink. Only let me pass through on foot, just as the descendants of Esau, who dwell in Seir, and the Moabites who dwell in Ar, did for me, until I crossed the Jordan to the land which the Lord your God is giving us. But Sion, king of Heshbon, would not let us pass through. For the Lord your God hardened his spirit, like he did Pharaoh's, and made his heart obstinate, that he might deliver him into your hand as it is this day." Now it's interesting that Moses sent words of peace to this man, although God had said he's going to destroy him. In fact, Moses sent the same message to Sion that he sent to the king of Edom, whom God had told him not to destroy. He said, "I'll just pass through, mind my own business. Anything I eat or drink of your possessions, we'll pay good money for it. We'll not try to, you know, take over or engage in military exploits against you. Just let us pass through." And apparently, if King Sion had agreed to that, Moses would have to keep his word and would not be able to do what God had told him to do. But God sovereignly moved on the situation and hardened the spirit and the heart of Sion so that Sion did come out and fight with him. Well, a thought came to my head that would have been interesting to explore, but I don't think we have time, so I'll move along. I was just wondering, I'll tell you what it is, I won't have time to explore it with you. I wonder if there may be a textual problem in Numbers chapter 20, because this is exactly what is said that the Edomites did in Numbers 20, which doesn't sound like it agrees with what Deuteronomy says the Edomites did. Deuteronomy indicates that the Edomites let them pass through and did these things. Whereas, as I pointed out earlier, Numbers 20 talks about Moses making this very offer to the Edomites. And the Edomites, you know, being hostile about it and so forth. Now, I don't know. I mean, there'd certainly be no way to prove this. I mean, the text, obviously, if it was corrupted, we've lost track of the earlier ways. It's just something that crossed my mind. And it certainly would be a waste of our time to try to explore that too much. But it's interesting that what it says King Sion did here is really what it says the Edomites did in our text of Numbers as it stands. I wonder if there's any possibility that the text of Numbers originally said the people of Heshbon rather than the people of Edom, and that somehow a textual discrepancy has come in through copying. Anyway, not worthy of our taking time out to consider that too much. It just crossed my mind. Anyway, shouldn't say those things. Verse 31. And the Lord said to me, "See, I have begun to give Sion and his land over to you. Begin to possess it, that you may inherit his land." Then Sion and all his people came out against us to fight at Jahaz. And the Lord our God delivered him over to us. So we defeated him and his sons and his people. We took all his cities at that time. We utterly destroyed the men, women, and little ones of every city, just as they were supposed to do to all the Canaanite peoples. We left none remaining. We took only the livestock as plunder for ourselves, with the spoil of the cities which we took. From Aroer, which is on the bank of the river Arnon, and from that city, from the city that is in the ravine, as far as Gilead, there was not one city too strong for us. The Lord our God delivered all to us. Only you did not go near to the land of the people of Ammon, that is the descendants of Lot, or anywhere along the river Jabbok, or to the cities of the mountains, or wherever the Lord our God had forbidden us. Continuing, we have another battle, very similar to the one with King Sion, is the one with King Og. Everything I've said about the battle with Sion also applies to Og. The same purposes for the battle, the same basic results. Then we turned and went up the road to Bashan, and Og, the king of Bashan, came out against us, he and all his people, to battle at Edrei. And the Lord said to me, "Do not fear him, for I have delivered him and all his people and his land into your hand. You shall do to him as you did to Sion, king of the Amorites, who dwelt at Heshbon." So the Lord our God also delivered into our hands Og, the king of Bashan, with all his people, and we attacked him until he had no survivors remaining. And we took all his cities at that time. There was not a city which we did not take from them, 60 cities, all of the region of Argob, the kingdom of Og, and Bashan. All these cities were fortified with high walls, gates, and bars, besides the great many rural towns. Now this statement, all these cities were fortified with high walls, if you go back to the earlier part of this same discourse, in chapter 1, verse 28, when he describes how the evil report of the spies had discouraged the people, what the people said in chapter 1, 28, says, "Where can we go up? Our brethren have discouraged our hearts, saying, 'The people are greater and taller than we. The cities are great and fortified up to heaven.'" In other words, the fact that they all had tall walls was one of the things that intimidated the Israelites about going in. And yet Moses reminds them, hey, Og's cities, they all had high walls, and God has delivered them over to us, hasn't he? Therefore, don't be afraid when you see those high walls you heard about 40 years ago, 38 years ago, from the spies on the other side of Jordan. God has already turned over to us the cities that had high walls on this side of the Jordan. Don't be afraid of the high walls on the other side of the cities that you have to conquer there. Verse 6, we utterly destroyed them, as we did Sion, king of Heshbon, utterly destroying every man, woman, and child in every city. But all the livestock and the spoil of the cities we took as booty for ourselves. And at that time, we took the land from the hand of the two kings of the Amorites who were on the side of the Jordan, this side of the Jordan, from the river Arnon to Mount Hermon. The Sidonians call Hermon Sirion, and the Amorites call it Senir. All the cities of the plain, all Gilead and all Bashan, as far as Salcah and Edrei, cities of the kingdom of Og in Bashan. For only Og, king of Bashan, remained of the remnant of the giants. Now, this doesn't mean Og was the last surviving giant. The word giants there, in verse 11, is the word Rephaim in the Hebrew, which was one of the races of giants. Og was the last of the Rephaim. There were other giants, even in later history. For instance, Goliath and his four brothers are named in the books of Samuel and Chronicles. Goliath was a giant, and his four brothers were giants, and they were said to be the sons of a giant. But they were of a totally different race. They were Philistines. These are Rephaim of a very ancient race of giants that ceased to exist at this time, 1,400 years before Christ. So when it says he was the last of the giants, that's how the English translation renders it. That would confuse you if you later thought, well, what about Goliath? He was a lot after this. Wasn't he a giant? Yeah, Og was the last of the Rephaim, that particular race of giants. He was the last survivor. He was a big one, by the way. He's the biggest giant named in the Bible as far as his size. We're told in verse 11, indeed, his bedstead was an iron bedstead. Is it not in Reba of the people of Ammon? Apparently they kept it as a museum piece. It was so big. 9 cubits is its length and 4 cubits its width, according to the standard cubits. So if you want to know what a king-size bed is, this king slept in a bed that was 6 feet wide, which is really like a king-size bed now, I guess, but 13 and a half feet long. Now, whether he was 13 and a half feet tall himself, we're not told, but his bed was 13 and a half feet long, and it was probably custom-made for him, so he must have been pretty close to that length himself. So he's, as far as we can tell, the largest giant whose size is given in the Bible.
Goliath a Nephilim, or is that a different race?
No, he wasn't a Nephilim. Actually, the word Nephilim is used only twice in the Bible. Once in Genesis 6, where it says, after the sons of God married the daughters of men and so forth, it says there were Nephilim in the world in those days. The only other time is in Numbers 14, where the children of Israel come back from spying out the land, and they say, we saw Nephilim there, and also the Anakim. Apparently, Nephilim is a type of giants, also, like the Anakim are. But since we have so few references to them, and by the way, they're not found in the Hebrew language outside the Bible. So it's a word that's unknown in Hebrew, except in two places in the Bible, neither of which really explains it. But in the case of Numbers 14, it sounds like it's talking about giants. So that's why it's translated giants also in Genesis 6. But they would not have been of the same race as Goliath. Goliath is distinctly said to have been a Philistine, which would be from the island of Crete initially, his roots. So he'd be of a different stock entirely. So there were a number of different races, independent from each other, genetically, that were giants. Why this was so, I don't know. Of course, there are genetic giants even to this day, though they're very rare. We don't have races of them anymore. Although the Watusis, I guess, and the legendary Amazons, the 7-foot-tall women of South America, who I don't know if they exist anymore or ever did, but I guess they were legendary. There are, of course, races of people and families that are a lot bigger, tend to be taller than others, but we don't have very many people walking around 10 feet and above these days. But if you look in, you know, Guinness World Records, you know, the tallest man and so forth alive today, you'll find there's someone in there who's probably about 9 feet tall or something like that. I mean, you do have occasional giants. And apparently, in ancient times, there were some races where this genetic trait was predominant. We're not talking about giants like the Jack and the Beanstalk type giants, you know, where you wouldn't even stand up to his ankles next to him. But we're just talking about large men, very large men. Verse 12. And this land which we possessed at that time, from Aroer, which is by the river Arnon, and half the mountains of Gilead and its cities, this is all the region east of Jordan, I gave to the Reubenites and the Gadites and the rest of Gilead and all Bashan and the kingdom of Og I gave to the half-tribe of Manasseh. All the region of Argob with all Bashan was called the land of the giants previously, of the Rephaim. So the Rephaim giants apparently inhabited that entire land at one time, but in the days of Moses, only Og remained of that race, and he got killed by them. This dividing of that portion of the land to Reuben and Manasseh and Gad is mentioned in more detail in Numbers chapter 32. Moses doesn't mention it here, but in Numbers we're told that this was at the request of those tribes. They saw that it was good grazing land, and they had a lot of livestock, and they asked Moses for permission to stay on that side of the land. And Moses at first was angry with them. He thought they were trying to cop out and avoid, you know, the struggles on the other side of Jordan, and thought they were doing something a little bit like what their fathers had done at Kadesh Barnea when they had backed out and provoked God. But when he consulted God about it, God says, no, that's okay. I'm going to give this land to them. But he did require that they go over with their brethren to fight the war within Canaan before possessing it. And that's what Moses goes on to tell here. I won't read verses 14 through 17, which basically just gives place names, which are not of much meaning to us, but they describe the borders of each of Reuben, Gad, and Manasseh's territory on the eastern side of the Jordan. Verse 18, and I commanded you at that time, saying, The Lord your God has given you this land to possess. He's talking about those 2.5 tribes. All you men of valor shall cross over armed before your brethren, the children of Israel. But your wives, your little ones, and your livestock, I know that you have much livestock, shall stay in your cities which I have given you, that is over here on the east of Jordan, until the Lord has given rest to your brethren as to you. And they shall possess the land which the Lord your God is giving them beyond the Jordan. Then each of you may return to his possession which I have given you. And I commanded... Well, let's stop there a minute. As I said, the conditions under which the Reubenites and the Gadites and the Manassites could take this land was that they leave their families on that side, but they go over themselves to fight the battles with the children of Israel. They were not to have an easier situation than the others. They agreed to this. They had no problem with that. The taking of the land is here called to be entering into rest. In verse 20, until the Lord has given rest to your brethren as to you. Entering into rest. This later became a term that was used frequently, several times, for entering into Canaan. For instance, if you turn later, much later, in chapter 95 of the Psalms. In Psalm 95, in verse 7, the latter part of that verse, in reading several verses, says, today if you will hear his voice. Psalm 95:8. Do not harden your hearts as in the provocation, and as in the day of trial in the wilderness, when your fathers tested me and proved me, though they saw my work. For 40 years I was grieved with that generation, and I said, it is a people who go astray in their hearts, and they do not know my ways. So I swore in my wrath, they shall not enter my rest. That is, he swore that that generation would not enter Canaan, but they'd die in the wilderness. The way it is phrased by God in Psalm 95 is, I swore they would not enter my rest, referring to the rest from their wanderings, the rest from their 40 years of homelessness, the rest that is represented by settling into their own homes and farms in Canaan, and every man under his own vine and fig tree, and being insecure and so forth. That's the rest that he's talking about. And coming into Canaan, in Deuteronomy and also in Psalms, is referred to as entering into rest. Hebrews picks up this theme and this language and gives us an application to ourselves. In Hebrews chapter 3, it quotes this psalm, Psalm 95, that we just read. And verses 18 and 19 of chapter 3, it says, and to whom did he swear that they would not enter into his rest, but to those who did not obey? So we see that they could not enter in because of unbelief. Then in chapter 4, he goes on to say, therefore, since a promise remains of entering his rest. Now, where does the writer of Hebrews get the impression that a promise remains of entering his rest? He's just been talking about the Jews were not permitted to enter into Canaan. That is, the ones at the provocation were not permitted to. And from that, he leaps to, there remains a promise to enter into his rest available to us. Where does he get that from? He gets that from Psalm 95, which he's been quoting from. As he develops chapter 4, he points out, let me show you down a few verses down here. Verse 8, Hebrews 4:8. For if Joshua had given them rest, and of course Joshua is the one who finally did lead them into the settlement of the land of Canaan, which was rest, but he's questioning whether that's really the rest that is ultimately promised. If Joshua had given them rest, then he would not afterward have spoken of another day. That is, afterwards in Psalm 95, David would not have said, today, if you hear your voice, if you hear his voice, don't harden your hearts, but enter into his rest. That is to say, even after Joshua led the children of Israel into the rest of Canaan, and they conquered Canaan and settled in, yet later than that, 400 years later, David says, today, if you hear his voice, don't harden your hearts. And the writer of Hebrews says, you see, David even invited his own generation to enter into that rest. Therefore, Joshua, who did lead the children into Canaan, must not have led them ultimately into the rest. He led them into the rest of Canaan, which was only a type of a greater rest. And he says that in verse 9. Hebrews 4:9. There remains, therefore, a rest for the people of God. For he who has entered into his rest has himself also ceased from his works as God did from his. Let us be diligent, therefore, to enter that rest, lest anyone fall after the same example of disobedience. Now, what is that rest? In Hebrews 4:1, he says, there remains a promise for us of entering into his rest. In chapter 4, verse 9, it says, there remains a rest for the people of God. By the way, in chapter 4, verse 8, excuse me, verse 9, the word rest is a different word there. It's the word Sabbath keeping, a keeping of Sabbath. Just in that one spot. Genesis 2, verse 2. And God rested on the seventh day from all his works. Now there's two Old Testament rests that the writer of Hebrews is bringing into one passage. The rest of God on the Sabbath, the first Sabbath, when God rested from his completed work, on the one hand. But also the Canaan rest, which we read of in Deuteronomy, but we also read of in Psalm 95. Those people who provoked God at Kadesh Barnea would not enter into that rest, and yet David's generation was invited to enter into it. So the writer of Hebrews is kind of taken two different things in the Old Testament about rest. One is a Sabbath rest, the other is the Canaan rest, and he takes both of them as though they are both a type of a rest that really belongs to the Christian, the ultimate rest. And he says that in verse 9. There remains therefore a rest, a Sabbath kind of rest, for the people of God. For he who has entered into God's rest has himself also ceased from his own works as God took it from his. There's two ways we can understand this as Christians. One is we could understand it as going to heaven and ceasing from our works. The Bible in certain places, I'm sorry, I can't remember exactly where, I know in Revelation, I think chapter 1 is one of the, I mean chapter 7, I think is one of those places. But it talks about those who have died in the Lord have ceased from their work, from their labors, you know. And when we die, we do cease from our works. And we do enter into ultimate rest. And there's a number of times in the Scripture, even in the Old Testament, Isaiah 57, verses 1 and 2, it talks about the righteous who dies, he shall enter into rest, it says. So there is a rest that Christians enter into if they die saved. They go into their rest. In fact, doesn't Paul essentially use that same concept in 2 Thessalonians, which we've already studied, chapter 1. 2 Thessalonians 1:7, he says, and to give you who are troubled rest with us when the Lord Jesus is revealed from heaven with his mighty angels. Now, it's the end of this life. Whether it's when Jesus comes back or when you die, God gives us rest. And the writer of Hebrews may very well have that rest in mind. There remains a rest for us. We better labor to enter into it. We better be careful not to fall short of it through unbelief. We better not backslide before we get there, in other words. There is another view, which is very common, and I myself have taught it many times, and I think it is probably a secondary view in the mind of the author. And that is a rest of faith that we enter into even now. The New Testament frequently talks about the future hope, the future new heavens, new earth, the new creation, and so forth, is already broken into our own experience, spiritually speaking, in a sense. It says in 2 Corinthians 5:17, if any man is in Christ, he is a new creation. Old things are passed away and everything has become new. Well, that's not literally going to happen universally until Jesus comes back when there's a new creation to replace this creation. But to a Christian, it's already a reality inwardly. Likewise, of course, that's 2 Corinthians 5:17. In Hebrews chapter 6, and describing the Christian experience in verse 5, he says that a Christian is one who has tasted of the good word of God and the powers of the age to come. The age to come hasn't come, but we have tasted of the powers of it already. The Christian, in a sense, looks forward to an ultimate rest when Jesus comes back or when we die, but we have already tasted of that in one sense. And that is the rest that comes as a result of ceasing from our own works. That is, from striving to be good enough, from striving to win salvation through our own performance, from ceasing from a legalistic works righteousness mentality where we're nervously always trying to perform and earn and measure up. We rest from that when we come into Christ. By faith, we trust in the finished work of Christ and we rest in him. Jesus said, come unto me, all you who labor and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, he says. And he says, and you shall find rest to your souls. Matthew 11. Verse, I think it's 28, 29, or 29, 30, somewhere around there. So there's a rest to our souls that Jesus promises us from the burdensomeness of legalistic religion. That's certainly the heavy ladenness that he was speaking of the Jews of his day. You who are burdened and heavy laden. Jesus said the Pharisees laid heavy burdens on the backs of these people. the legalism of their religion was a heavy burden, but Jesus said, I'll give you rest from that. And so the finished work of Jesus, when we put our trust in that, is sort of like a Sabbath rest, because when God rested on the seventh day, it was because his work of creation was completed. He rested because there was a finished work. Likewise, the work of redemption has been completed in Christ, and we now can rest in a Sabbath sort of way upon the finished work. And the writer of Hebrews brings out that particular finished work as well in Hebrews chapter 10. In Hebrews chapter 10, it contrasts Christ with the Old Testament priests. The Old Testament priests never could stop offering sacrifices because the sacrifices they offered never really put a final end to sins. And he says in Hebrews 10:11, and every priest stands ministering daily and offering repeatedly the same sacrifices, which can never take away sins. But this man, Jesus, after he had offered one sacrifice for sins forever, sat down at the right hand of God. That is, the priests of the Old Testament could never sit down. Their job was never done. They had to stand continually, he says in verse 11. But Jesus, by contrast, offered one sacrifice, and that was good enough forever, so he could sit down. He could rest. He could take his position of repose and rest in the fact that his work was sufficient and finished. And therefore, we enter into his rest when we are seated in him in heavenly places. We are resting in his finished work. So there is a double rest for the Christian. One is the ultimate rest that comes when Jesus comes back or when we die. And we must labor to enter into that rest. But likewise, there is a sense in which we already spiritually partake of that reality. Because of the finished work of Christ, we can cease from our own works. That doesn't mean we don't do good works, but the works we now do are his works done in us through his Spirit. They're not our own works anymore. It's simply we become the agents of God doing his works through us by his Spirit. But before, the Jews' works were their own. They had to come up with it out of their own self, out of their own flesh, out of their own resolve and willpower and so forth. We have God working in us to will and to do of his good pleasure, and therefore they're not our own works. Right. That's what, Philippians 2:13? Okay. Let's get back to this now. So, Paul. Moses said to the Reubenites and the Gadites and the Manassites, you go over and fight with brother until they enter into their rest. Now, if the ultimate rest for the Christian is when we die and go to heaven, that would suggest that until all of our brothers have reached that stage, we cannot consider ourselves discharged from the battle. You know, we sometimes go through struggles in our earlier life and we finally reach a place of security and comfort and so forth, and we feel like, well, I can rest now, I've earned it. But you still have brethren in the world who are going through those struggles. You still have brethren who are fighting the fight. They haven't entered into their rest yet. And really, until Jesus comes back, really, until the ultimate rest is acquired, no one should consider himself discharged from the battle. And that's what he says to the Gadites and the Reubenites. The Lord has given, until the Lord has given rest to your brethren as to you, and they also possess the land which the Lord your God has given them beyond the Jordan. That's how long they're supposed to support their brethren in the military campaign. So, they got their inheritance at least defined for them, but they weren't able to possess it until their whole nation possessed their inheritance. And they had to remain fighters in the battle until then. Verse 21, and I commanded Joshua at that time, saying, your eyes have seen all that the Lord your God has done to these two kings. So will the Lord do to all the kingdoms through which you pass. You must not fear them, for the Lord your God himself fights for you. Then I pleaded with the Lord at that time, saying, O Lord God, you have begun to show your servant your greatness and your mighty hand. And what God is there in heaven or on earth who can do anything like your works and your mighty deeds? I pray, let me cross over and see the good land beyond the Jordan, those pleasant mountains in Lebanon. But the Lord was angry with me on your account. This is now the second time he says this. He's going to say it again. He said it in chapter 1, verse 37, and he says it, I believe, altogether three times in this discourse. Yeah, he says it again in chapter 4, verse 21. God was angry at me on your account, and he would not listen to me. So the Lord said to me, enough of that. Speak no more to me of this matter. So Moses wasn't even allowed to pray about it anymore. Go up to the top of Pisgah and lift up your eyes toward the west, the north, the south, and the east. Behold, It is with your behold it with your eyes, for you shall not cross over this Jordan. Now, in time to look the four directions, it certainly doesn't mean that as he stood there on the east side of the Jordan, he was to look to the east of Pisgah. Well, I guess in a sense he could, since some of that land was on the east. But I think the mention of the four compass points is simply to suggest eventually the whole world. And the reason I say that is because the same thing, almost the same expression was used in Genesis 13 in speaking to Abraham. In Genesis 13 and verses 14 and 15, the Lord said to Abram, after Lot had separated from him, "Lift up your eyes now and look from the place where you are, northward, southward, eastward, and westward. For all the land which you see, I give to you and your descendants forever." Sounds just about like what he was saying to Moses here. Look northward, eastward, southward, that's the land I'm going to give. Well, Paul interpreted this promise to Abram as encompassing the whole world. And the four compass points mentioned together often simply refer to the whole world. Although, of course, initially, the type in the Old Testament was the land of Canaan. The antitype, or the fulfillment of it, is when Abram's seed inherits the whole world. And we see that in the fourth chapter of Romans, verse 13. Romans 4:13, it says, "For the promise that he would be the heir of the world was not made to Abraham nor his seed through the law, but through the righteousness of faith." Now, you don't find anywhere in the Old Testament that says outright, "Abraham, I'm going to make you the heir of the world." The closest you get to it is in chapter 13 of Genesis, which we just read. Look northward, southward, eastward, westward, I'm going to give it all to you and your seed. Well, of course, Abram may have that only to be Canaan, but Paul understands that to ultimately refer to as far as you can see and even beyond, in every direction. I'm giving it all, the world, to your seed, and his seed is Christ. And it says of Jesus in Psalm chapter 2 and verse 8, "The Lord said unto me, ask of me, and I will give you the heathen for your inheritance, and the uttermost parts of the earth for your possession." That's what God the Father says to Jesus. "Ask me, Jesus, and I will give you the heathen for your inheritance, and the uttermost parts of the earth for your possession." Psalm 2:8. So Jesus is to inherit the whole earth, and we with him, because we are in him. We are his Abraham's seed in Christ. And so Jesus said to his disciples, "Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth." The promise has to do with the inheriting of the earth. And I think that in Deuteronomy, though Moses told to look, eastward as well as westward, southward, northward, rather than saying specifically that all the area east of Jordan as well as west of Jordan is going to be the inheritance of the Israelites as the result of their conquests, rather that it is an echoing of the promise of world dominion that was given to Abram for his seed, Christ, ultimately to inherit. Verse 28, Deuteronomy 3:28, "But command Joshua and encourage him." Many times it is said that Joshua has to be encouraged. Why would he have to be so encouraged? Well, he had been with Moses the whole time. He saw how these people were. Joshua never had to bear the brunt of their rebellion. He just got to be a bystander and watch them attack Moses and Aaron dozens of times as they wandered through the wilderness. But he could stand by and say, "I'm glad it's not me." But now it was going to be him. Now he was the one who was going to step into Moses' shoes and take the lead of these people. He knew how rebellious they were, and he's going to have to really have courage to take command of such an unwieldy bunch. And so many times God tells Moses, encourage Joshua. And he says, command Joshua and encourage him and strengthen him, and he shall... "For he shall go over before this people, and he shall cause them to inherit the land which you see." So we stayed in the valley opposite Beth Peor. Now, there's many times in Numbers and in Deuteronomy, and in the book of Joshua itself, where God is trying to give Joshua encouragement. And apparently, when Moses was alive, these words of encouragement came through Moses as the mouthpiece. But after Moses was dead, almost the same words were given to Joshua in Joshua 1. Where apparently God spoke directly to him, Joshua himself being like a prophet now. In Joshua 1, beginning at verse 1, all the way back to verse 2, "Moses, my servant, is dead. Now therefore arise and go over this Jordan." And then he tells him several times, "Be strong and of good courage, be strong and of good courage." Verse 6, "Be strong and of good courage." Yeah. Verse 7, only be strong and very courageous. Verse 9, have I not commanded you, be strong and of good courage. Joshua apparently was a man who was somewhat timid by nature, but had to be encouraged to be strong and of good courage. And so God gave him that encouragement through Moses, and then after Moses' death, directly to him, apparently prophetically. Now back to Deuteronomy 4. Now, O Israel, listen to the statutes and the judgments which I teach you to observe, that you may live and go in and possess the land which the Lord your God of your fathers has given you. You shall not add to the word which I command you, nor take anything from it, that you may keep the commandments of the Lord your God which I command you. Your eyes have seen what the Lord did at Baal Peor. That's where they did the sin with the Midianite Moabite women at the council of Balaam, and a plague came upon them. For the Lord your God has destroyed from among you all the men who followed Baal at Peor. But you held fast to the Lord your God, who are alive today, every one of you. Surely I have taught you the statutes and judgments, just as the Lord my God commanded me, that you should act according to them in the land which you go to possess. Therefore, be careful to observe them, and for this is your wisdom and your understanding in the sight of all the peoples who will hear all these statutes and say, surely this great nation is a wise and understanding people. For what great nation is there that has God so near to it as the Lord our God is to us, for whatever reason we may call upon him? And what great nation is there that has such statutes and righteous judgments as are in all this law which I set before you this day? Now, he makes it clear that while these laws have only really been given to Israel, they will be the marvel in terms of their wisdom and their self-evident justice or righteousness. They will be the wonder of the Gentile nations who become aware of them. When Gentiles see them, they say, wow, what nation ever had such wise and just laws like this? Now, this has really been fulfilled very much. At least not every nation in the world, of course, has been influenced by the Mosaic Law, but all of those cultures that are the overflow of European culture, of Western European culture, which would include Western Europe and America and Australia and much of Africa and Asia and South America, that have all been colonized and inhabited by persons affected by the Judeo-Christian ethic. And it's incredible how much of the Mosaic Law really was just taken right across the board into the English common law, which originally gave form to the legal systems of the colonized continents like our own as well. More and more, our own society and Western Europe are moving further from these biblical standards. But for centuries, the law of Moses was just recognized as the epitome of justice and rightness. Now, the Reconstructionists believe that someday Christians will be the dominant political force and societal force, and that lawmaking bodies will be governed by Christians. And at that time, when Christians in lawmaking capacities in government decide, well, what kind of laws should we make, they will go back to the law of Moses and establish those laws, because they are the wisest and most righteous civil laws and societal laws that have ever been given to any nation. I personally would say, if a Christian does find himself in a lawmaking capacity, he probably would do no better than to use the law of Moses as a standard of righteousness for making laws. I do not necessarily agree with Reconstructionists in their vision of postmillennialism. I don't believe that the church necessarily will hold the power structures of society in the future. I believe we're strangers and pilgrims in this country, in this land, in this world. And in all likelihood, as I understand Scripture, and I may misunderstand it, but I believe that we'll still be a minority, probably a hated minority, until the day Jesus returns. But at any rate, I don't disagree with them philosophically that if laws are to be made by any land, at least the civil ordinances and statutes that God gave Israel are the most righteous laws ever given to any people, and therefore should set standards for lawmakers, whether they're Christian or not. Even non-Christian lawmakers are required by God to do the just thing. And there's nothing more just than the laws that God himself has made. Well, let's go on. Verse 9. Only take heed to yourself and diligently keep yourself, lest you forget the things your eyes have seen, and lest they depart from your heart all the days of your life. And teach them to your children and your grandchildren. This will be a recurring refrain. Teach them to your children and your grandchildren. Moses was particularly concerned that the truth be preserved generation after generation. He knew that he would not be there for another generation of Israelites. And it would be up to the parents now to keep their children and their grandchildren educated in these things. Not up to the Sunday school, nor the Christian school, but the parents. Their responsibility to pass this along. Especially concerning the day you stood before the Lord your God in Horeb, when the Lord said to me, gather the people to me, and I will let them hear my words, that they may learn to fear me all the days that they live on the earth, and that they may teach their children. Then you came near and stood at the foot of the mountain, and the mountain burned with fire to the midst of heaven, with darkness, cloud, and thick darkness. And the Lord spoke to you out of the midst of the fire. You heard the sound of words, but you saw no form. You only heard the voice. So he declared to you his covenant, which he commanded you to perform, that is, the Ten Commandments. And he wrote them on two stone tablets. And the Lord commanded me at that time to teach you statutes and judgments, that you might observe them in the land which you cross over to possess. Now, he talks to these people as though they were personally at Mount Sinai. The fact is, only those persons who were at this time over 40 years old, that is, everyone between 40 and 60 years old, had been at Mount Sinai, but most of them had been children. I mean, a lot of them had been infants and children at the time, though a few of them had been in their late teens. Everybody who was 40 years and under listening to his words on this had not been there. But he clearly is addressing his remarks to that segment of the society, perhaps 30% of the society, who were above the age of 40 and who would therefore have some living memory to pass along to the younger generation of what had taken place at Horeb. Now he emphasizes in verse 12, you heard the sound of words, but you didn't see any form. God didn't show you what he looked like. He just let you hear his words. Why is that? Well, he tells them in verse 15 and 16, take careful heed to yourselves, for you saw no form when the Lord spoke to you at Horeb out of the midst of the fire, lest you act corruptly and make for yourselves a carved image in the form of any figure, the likeness of male or female, the likeness of any beast that is on the earth, the likeness of any winged bird that flies in the air, the likeness of anything that creeps on the ground, or the likeness of any fish that is in the water beneath the earth. Now, what he's saying is, since God didn't show you what he looks like, obviously, you can't make a picture of him. You can't make an idol of him. You can't represent him. He deliberately didn't let you know what he looked like, lest you would be tempted to do just that. He did not reveal what he looks like. He only let you hear his words. Now, the children of Israel were forbidden to make an image of God of his appearance. But there's a sense in which what he did reveal could be imaged. He revealed his words. And his words are supposed to be imaged in our lives. God doesn't desire us to represent him with carved images, but he does expect us to represent his character by our behavior, that his word would be made flesh in us as in Christ. Not exactly as in Christ, but in a slightly different sense. Just as Jesus was the embodiment and the visible demonstration of what God's words are, the word was made flesh in him, so the way we live should be the fleshing out of his words and his teaching. And so with the Israelites, they were not to be so concerned with making a visible image of his likeness out of wood or stone. In fact, they were forbidden to do that. But they did have his words. And if they wished to really represent him visibly, let them represent his character by living according to his words and imaging him in that way in their own lives rather than with the works of their hands. Verse 19, and take heed, lest you lift up your eyes to heaven, and when you see the sun and the moon and the stars and all the host of heaven, you feel driven to worship them and to serve them, which the Lord your God has given to all the peoples under the whole heaven as a heritage. But the Lord has taken you and brought you out of the iron furnace, out of Egypt, to be his people, his inheritance, as you are this day. Now, the reason he gives, although it certainly isn't the only reason for it, but the reason he mentions for not worshiping the sun, moon, and the stars is because God has given those to all the peoples under the whole heaven as a heritage, whereas he's given the Jews a special circumstance. He's brought them out of Egypt to make him his own possession, his own inheritance. The idea being, why worship those objects which are common to all men when you have a very distinctive privilege of being the only people that the true God has brought out of Egypt? The heathen don't have any history with the true God. That is, that generation of them didn't. He hadn't delivered them out of Egypt. That is the heathen. The best they could do was to admire the sun, moon, and stars, but the Israelites could do better than that. They had the true God, and therefore let them not make the mistake of stepping off their pedestal of specialness, who have a special relation with God, and to go to worshiping those things which are the common objects of worship of all people who don't have any special relationship with God. Now, it's interesting that he says, when you see the sun and the moon and the stars, all those heaven, you might feel driven to worship them. I remember reading, to my surprise, in one of the works of C.S. Lewis, I don't remember which one, that when he went to Stonehenge, and when he went to Greece, and to the Acropolis, and places where the heathen had worshipped their deities and their gods, that he felt this strange drive inside to worship the pagan gods, which he said he resisted, and he didn't do it. But it's strange. He said he felt this drive. Now, I've never been to those places, and I don't know what kind of spiritual dynamics may be attached to those places of worship of the heathen, but the Bible does say there are demons that stand behind the worshiping of idols. Of course, 1 Corinthians 10:20 says that. The things that the heathen sacrifice, they sacrifice to demons and not to God. So that idol worship isn't just something that man dreamed up. It is something that mankind was drawn into by demonic forces. And there is apparently a warfare to watch out for, to beware of being drawn, not by our human nature perhaps, but by demonic forces, to worship objects rather than God. And even Christians, I think, are in danger of being drawn into idolatry inadvertently or against their will to a certain extent, if they're not waging warfare against it. For instance, we're told that covetousness is idolatry in Ephesians 5:5 and Colossians 3:5. It tells us that covetousness is idolatry. I certainly know a lot of Christians who are drawn into that. I know Christians, including myself at one time, I don't think it's quite the danger it was to me some years ago, but I used to practically worship my children. I used to think, well, I could endure any torture for Jesus' sake without denying him, but what if my children were being tortured? Would I deny the Lord, you know, to relieve them? And it was a hard thing to answer. I could answer that now. I had to work that out. When I started having children, they meant more to me than they should have. Like Abraham and Isaac, you know. Abraham had to be tested to see whether his son was too important to him, whether he was an idol or not. But I think there are people for whom their children are idols. There are many idols. Even in churches, even in Protestant churches, there are idols. And there is just something about idolatry. There's a demonic thing behind it that draws you if you're not warring against it. God anticipated that when they'd look up and see the sun, moon, stars, and the light, they'd be driven to worship them. Not driven by, you know, at the point of a sword, by the heathen saying, bow down to these, but rather something inward. And he says, don't do it. And he says, what a cheap religion that is compared to what you have. All the nations under heaven have the sun, moon, and stars to look at, but you alone have a God who has revealed himself to you and taken you out of Egypt. And he says, therefore, you are uniquely his, and therefore do not step down off that pedestal of uniqueness by going after the gods that the heathen all admire. Verse 21, furthermore, the Lord was angry with me for your sakes. This is the third time he says this. He apparently is kind of bitter about this. And swore that I would not cross over the Jordan and that I would not enter the good land which the Lord your God is giving you as an inheritance. But I must die in this land. I must not cross over the Jordan, but you shall cross over and possess the good land. Take heed to yourselves, lest you forget the covenant of the Lord your God, which he made with you, and make for yourselves a carved image in the form of anything which the Lord your God has forbidden. For the Lord your God is a consuming fire, a jealous God. Both of these expressions are found elsewhere in Scripture. The first reference of Scripture to God's jealousy was back when he gave the Ten Commandments in Exodus 20. When he gave the commandment against idols, in fact, against idolatry. In verse 5, he says, "For the Lord your God is a jealous God, visiting the iniquity of the children of the fathers of the children to the third and fourth generation." He's described himself as a jealous husband there. He's a jealous husband. He doesn't like adultery. Doesn't like his wife to go out and sleep or worship other gods. It's like sleeping with other men. It's spiritual adultery. And God is a jealous husband. Then it says he's a consuming fire. Probably a verse in the New Testament comes to mind immediately for most of you. In Hebrews chapter 12 and verse 29, it says, "For our God is a consuming fire." Obviously quoting from this passage. In Hebrews 12, if I understand the context correctly, he's actually anticipating the destruction of Jerusalem in 70 AD. He talks about how we need to hang on to our kingdom, which cannot be moved, because the old one is about to be vanishing away, and our God is a consuming fire. I believe the fires that consumed Jerusalem in 70 AD may be in the author of Hebrews' mind when he says this. Deuteronomy also goes on to speak of God's judgment upon them for their idolatry as consuming fire. In fact, he goes on to, immediately after that in this chapter, he goes on to talk about their apostasy. If they apostatize, they'll be driven out of their land, just like the Jews were in 70 AD. So he threatens that they will be, even at this early date. In my opinion, the apostasy that Moses here predicts, that we're about to read, was the Babylonian captivity, was that which precipitated the Babylonian captivity. Later, in chapter 28, he warns them again about being scattered because of their apostasy. And I believe that the description he gives there in great detail looks more like 70 AD. There have been two times when God fulfilled his threat to Israel about this. Once was in 586 BC when Nebuchadnezzar took them into captivity, and the other time was 70 AD when the Romans did. And just from the details that are given in the description, it seems to me that here we're about to read the threat of the Babylonian captivity. Whereas when we get to a similar sounding threat, but not identical, in chapter 28, it'll be the ultimate banishment from the land in 70 AD. Here, verse 25, "When you beget children and grandchildren and have grown old in the land and act corruptly and make carved image in the form of anything and do evil in the sight of the Lord your God to provoke him to anger, I call heaven and earth to witness against you this day that you will soon utterly perish from the land which you crossed over the Jordan to possess. You will not prolong your days in it, but will be utterly destroyed." So their being in the land is something that's conditional. If they corrupt themselves with idols, they will be destroyed from the land, perish from the land. "And the Lord will scatter you among all the peoples, and you will be left few in number among the nations where the Lord will drive you. And there you will serve their gods, the work of men's hands, wood and stone, which neither see nor hear nor eat nor smell." Now when it says you will serve their gods, it doesn't necessarily mean that they'll worship idols there. I don't know. Actually, the Bible does not imply that the Jews worshipped idols when they were in Babylon. And we certainly know that the Jews are not worshipping idols overtly since 70 AD either. But when it says you shall serve other gods, it probably means you will come under the dominion of these other gods. You'll come into their territory. You'll be slaves under people who are under those gods. Not necessarily that you will worship those gods yourself. But whereas you have the opportunity to live in freedom and to serve your own God in your own land, you'll come into the land that is dominated by other religions and other gods that you don't know. And people who are fearing other gods will be your lords. And therefore you will be a slave under other gods rather than under the true gods. That's how I understand his threat here in verse 28. "But from there," that is in Babylon, "if you will seek the Lord your God," I'm sorry, it doesn't say if, it just says you will seek the Lord your God. I think the King James says if I'm not mistaken. At least in one of these passages it does. At any rate, he's still speaking hypothetically all the way through, but of course we know that it all was fulfilled. "But from there you will seek the Lord your God, and you will find him if you seek with him with all your heart, with all your soul. When you are in distress and all these things come upon you in the latter days." Now that doesn't mean the end of the world. Latter days just is an expression in the Old Testament. It means days later than this. Sometime in the future. You can, if you do a word study on that, as I've done, you'll find the latter days is simply used to speak of sometime in the future. it's not a definite period of time. When you turn to the Lord your God and obey His voice, for the Lord your God is a merciful God, He will not forsake you, nor destroy you, nor forget the covenant of your fathers, which He swore to them. That is the Abrahamic covenant, as opposed to the Sinaitic covenant, which we'll look at. The two covenants are mentioned in Deuteronomy. Now, when we get to chapter 5, not now, in our next session, I will tell you some of we'll survey what it says about the Abrahamic covenant in this chapter, in this book, and also the Sinaitic covenant. It says, God will not just forget the covenant of your fathers, which He swore to them. For ask now concerning the days that are past, which were before you, since the day that God created man on the earth, and ask from one end of heaven to the other, whether any great thing like this has happened or anything like it has been heard. Did any people ever hear the voice of God speaking out of the midst of the fire, as you have heard and live? Or did God ever try to go and take for Himself a nation from the midst of another nation by trials, by signs and wonders, by war, by a mighty hand and an outstretched arm, and by great terrors, according to all that the Lord your God did for you in Egypt before your eyes? Now, there's two things he said, did any other people ever have happen to them? One, did any other people hear their God speak to them? Two, did any other people ever get real deliverance? Anything like what the Israelites experienced, being delivered out of Egypt from their gods? The answer, of course, is no. The Israelites have a unique experience with their God that the heathens cannot boast of their relationship with their gods. The Israelites had heard the voice of God speaking from the midst of the fire. They had also been mightily delivered, objectively, out of bondage by their God. Now, what the Bible says elsewhere about the idols is that, one, they don't talk. In Psalm 115, verses 4 through 8, it describes the idols. Psalm 115, verses 4 through 8, you don't have to turn there. It says, the gods of the heathen are idols. They have eyes, but they can't see. They have ears, but they can't hear. They have mouths, but they don't speak. They got feet, but they can't move. They are helpless. They don't talk. They're dead. Likewise, Paul reminds the Corinthians in the passage I think you covered yesterday, chapter 12. Was that yesterday? He says in 1 Corinthians chapter 12 and verse 2, you know that before you were Christians, you Corinthians served dumb idols. Why dumb? They don't talk. Unlike your God, who you now worship, who does talk. And He gives some prophets and some tongues and interpretation of tongues and some word of wisdom, some word of knowledge. You've got a talking God now. He talks through His people, through the gifts of the Spirit. But you served dumb idols before. You didn't have gods to talk to you then. That's what he was saying. The idols don't talk. And so when he says in verse 3, did any people ever hear the voice of God speaking out of the midst of fire? The heathen who worship other gods certainly never heard their God speak like that. And the other question in verse 34, did God ever try to go and take for Himself a nation out of another nation? One thing that's stated emphatically in the prophets is that the idols cannot deliver. And it's stated as a mark of the foolishness of the Israelites when they went into idolatry, that they left worshiping a God who does and can and has delivered in order to worship gods that cannot. In Isaiah 46, for example, verses 1 and 2, it says, Bel stoops down, Nebo stoops. These are the gods of Babylon. Their idols were on the beasts and on the cattle. Your carriages were heavily loaded, a burden to the weary beasts. They stoop, they bow down together. They could not deliver the burden, but they themselves have gone into captivity. The idols, the chief gods of Babylon, Bel and Nebo, they couldn't deliver the burden, as they couldn't give a prophetic oracle. And they themselves have gone into captivity, much less can they deliver anyone else from captivity. In Jeremiah chapter 10, Jeremiah chapter 10 and verse 5 says, speaking of the idols, they are upright like a palm tree. They cannot speak. They must be carried because they cannot go by themselves. Don't be afraid of them, for they can't do evil, nor can they do any good. Why worship them? They can't do anything good for you. The prophets of the Old Testament frequently point out that the idols were helpless and could not help themselves, nor you, if you worship them. And so God points out to the Israelites they have a unique experience. Verse 35, to you it was shown, that you might know that the Lord Himself is God, there is none other beside Him. Out of heaven He let you hear His voice, that He might instruct you. On earth He showed you His great fire, and you heard His words out of the midst of the fire. And because He loved your fathers, therefore He chose their descendants after them. By the way, this is the first mention in the Bible of God's love for His people. It is a repeated theme, however, in Deuteronomy. We'll find references again to God's love for his people in chapter 7, verses 7 and 8. Also in Deuteronomy chapter 10, verse 15. And then again in chapter 33 and verse 3. In all those places there are references to God's love, but this is the first case in the whole Bible where it even mentions God loving anyone, his people. It says, God loved your fathers. The fathers here means Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Not necessarily the just immediate previous generation who were at Mount Sinai, although, of course, he chose their descendants, that is, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob's descendants after them. And he brought you out of Egypt with his presence and his mighty power, driving out from before you nations greater and mightier than you. Listen, the Canaanites are greater and mightier than you. But God has already driven out before you nations greater and mightier than you, so what do you have to be afraid of? To bring you in, to give you their land as an inheritance as it is this day. Therefore, know this day and consider it in your heart, that the Lord himself is God in heaven, above, and on the earth beneath. There is no other. You shall therefore keep his statutes and his commandments which I command you today, that it may go well with you and with your children after you, that you may prolong your days in the land which the Lord your God has given you for all time. Notice, the Lord your God has given this land to you for all time, so obey him so you can stay there. Interesting. Some people would understand, well, God gave this land for all time, therefore they can have it unconditionally. No. He gave it to them for all time, therefore behave so you can have it. It's yours forever, conditionally. Of course, as long as the covenant remained, until it was replaced by a new covenant. That's the end of the first discourse. Verses 41 through 43 simply tells us of three cities of refuge, one from each of the tribe of Manasseh and Gad and Reuben on the east side of Jordan. He does not at this point mention the three cities of refuge on the other side of the Jordan, another evidence of an early authorship here, another evidence of the genuineness of Moses being the author, since Moses did not live to see those other three cities appointed on the other side, apparently. Anyway, it gives them. We've seen about the cities of refuge also in Numbers 35. And then chapter 4, verse 44, we will not start right now because it really is an introduction to chapter 5. There seems to be a wrong division of the chapters here because the second discourse begins technically at chapter 5, verse 1, but the last verses are technically at verse 2. But the last verses of chapter 4 lead up to it to give the setting for it. So we'll save that for next time and use that as the beginning of chapter 5. Okay.